the familiar theme of our Monday morning movie reviews. That's right, it's Monday morning, and that's when we review the new movies and take a look at the box office. What did well, what didn't do well over the weekend? We'll analyze the box office. Eric Childress writes a box office piece every week, and we go through that and check out the big winners and losers at the box office, and then we'll jump into the new movies. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. You can also send your text to that same number, 312-981-7200. You can check us out at Twitter. Best way to stay connected, though, is on our Facebook page. Join well over 10,700 fans on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us. Whatever's happening on the radio is happening on our Facebook page. And the movie reviews are happening right now. Eric Childress, Colin Suter for eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com and more. Let's welcome them to the show. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
Okay. Interesting box office here. I was actually kind of stunned by it, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I really was. I mean, I should have known, though, when I went to see Pixels on a Saturday night, and the theater was less than half full, I should have known something was up. But your number one movie of the week is Ant-Man with $24.7 million, bringing its total up to $106 million. And then number two is Pixels with $24 million. So a movie that in its first week... a lot of people thought did disappointing numbers, to beat Pixels in its second week. Something is said about that. And what do you think of this, Eric? What did you write about this, about the whole Sandler thing? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, I think that the people have finally sort of caught up to the Sandler thing. And by that, I mean that he doesn't make good movies. I mean, we've been seeing this for, you know, last few years that, you know, with the exception of, like, the Grown Ups movies, you know, the movies that have just, you know, sort of boasted, you know, Sandler's name, your That's My Boy, your Jack and Jill, your Blended and whatnot, have not, you know, produced those numbers that he was sort of producing in the late 90s and, you know, the first half of the aughts, pretty much, or most of the aughts, actually, with the exception of the Grown Ups movies, which was both did very well. But I mean, and you have to think that, you know, the premise of Pixels, you know, forget about the quality of the movie. We'll talk about that later. But the premise of Pixels should be kind of a slam dunk summer number one opening. It just it lends itself. It's a high concept premise. You know, it's kind of original, and maybe not completely original, but it's kind of fun. It's, you know, sort of following in the footsteps of Wreck-It Ralph a little bit. But I think people, you know, see that trailer, you know, saw that trailer, you know, whenever it first premiered, and they go, oh, wow, what a cool Pac-Man. And then all of a sudden, they show Adam Sandler's face. And the reaction to that, I think, was sort of the same reaction that people had when, remember the movie Devil?
Yeah, yeah. I was just talking about this with Dan in the car Friday morning.
Devil.
Because we were talking about his new, Shyamalan Ding Dong's new movie with the crazy grandparents.
Right.
Called The Visit.
Right, exactly. Thank you, Blumhouse.
Yeah. I was just, honestly, man, I was just, Dan, didn't we just talked about this. I talked about the trailer for Devil. I remember sitting in the theater during and they showed the trailer for Devil, and during the first 45 seconds, you know, the room was quiet. People seemed, okay. And they were kind of hooked into it. And then it said, from the mind of M. Night Shyamalan. And everybody, there was audible laughs and like, oh, noes throughout the entire audience.
Yeah, no, and I think that's sort of the same reaction with Pixel. I think everyone was sort of looked like, this could be a really fun movie, you know, but the fact that Adam Sandler is sort of all over it. And I think even lost in the shuffle of this whole thing is that people, you know, didn't even realize that Chris Columbus directed it. It wasn't even one of Sandler's usual cronies.
Yeah, it wasn't Dugan.
Yeah, right. It wasn't Dugan. It wasn't Frank Caracci or any of these other guys. You know, it was someone who's actually got a little bit of experience doing sort of big-budget, special-effects-laden, you know, fantasy comedies and whatnot. And this thing just it crapped the bed.
Yeah.
This weekend.
Well, you know, here's the thing that I find interesting about I don't know, and again, we'll get into the details of what we thought of the movie in a little bit. But when you're talking about like you know, the advertising for this movie, I'm honestly, I don't know who this movie is for, and I can't help but like talk about this after having seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know who this movie is for, because people my age,
yeah,
are the ones that it should be aimed at. This, I mean, like if you're talking about, oh, this is going to be a great movie about Centipede and Pac-Man,
mm-hmm.
you know, in 1982, when this movie, the film opens in 1982,
yeah,
in the year 1982, I was 17 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was the age that these guys were going after.
Yeah.
And but like, you know, there were a lot of kids in the audience when I saw this movie. Well, I mean, a lot, meaning by a lot, considering how many people were actually in the theater.
Right.
A lot of them were kids. And to me, the kids got restless. I don't know if the kids know. There were so many 80s references in the movie.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
You know, I mean, like references that nobody's going to get, like kids aren't going to get. Nobody knows who the hell Max Headroom is. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like is a 7-year old or an 8-year old you take this movie to? Are they going to know who Hall and Oates are? No.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? They're not. And so it's this weird sort of thing where they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. We want to bring in the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the premise of this movie is aimed at middle-aged guys.
Yeah,
well, you'd be surprised at how much kids know about retro video games.
Oh, really?
I mean, they are kind of in vogue. I mean, all the other stuff you're talking about, like Max Headroom and Hall & Oates, no, that's going to go over their heads. But you know, what this movie's doing with, you know, just the basics, the Galaga, the Pac-Man, that stuff is actually, you know, kind of still around.
Okay, all right, I don't know. I'm not.
But it's still a stretch.
Yeah.
You know,
to
think that, you know, this thing's going to make, you know,
well,
250, 300
sure.
million based on that.
It also doesn't help that the screenplay completely sucks. But but we'll get to that. We'll get that.
Yeah.
Time. Okay. So Ant-Man, $24.7 million, bringing its total up to $106 million. Is Ant-Man going to prove the critics wrong?
I think so. I mean, it's doing pretty well overseas. It's done like another $120 million worldwide so far. So it's up to like $220 million, and the numbers suggest that, you know, this movie's going to go somewhere in the U.S. at least between $150 and $175. And if it makes that, it's only going to need about another $60-65 million worldwide to break even. So
yeah.
It's not going to be a gigantic hit for Marvel, but it's not going to be, I don't think it should be considered a disappointment if it, you know, just makes, you know, like a measly profit. You know, a movie like that, you know, we talked about this last week, you know, an origin story on a character that, you know, probably most people are not familiar with.
Yeah.
You know, starring Paul Rudd of all people is, you know, I think that they should consider that a success. I mean, that, you know, it's not Avengers, it's not Spider-Man, it's not any of the A-list characters. They should be very happy with what they're getting.
And personally, I think it's also a very entertaining movie, which I like.
I do too.
Much. Now, the other thing about Ant-Man is, how did Paul Rudd sign on for multiple films? I mean, because
Captain America movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Make that clear at the end. Is this one of those things? Is Marvel going to be like, oh man, you know, did we make a mistake having Rudd sign on to multiple films and now we're going to put him in the Captain America movie? But the Captain America movie, the thing is, that's already a proven box office success.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if what exactly the plans are. I mean, because I don't know what phase Marvel's in at this point, and I don't really care. But you know, I don't know if they have planned Ant-Man 2 or Ant-Man 3 the way they did. They have Thor and Captain and Iron Man and all that stuff. I won't be surprised when this movie does very well on home video. You know, I think it's really going to sort of find a second audience on home video. And you know, like I said, the movie is going to be a success. You know, I think people jumped the gun last week. You know, it wasn't the flashy, you know, 9-digit opening that, you know, some people seem to expect with these movies. It was right where I thought it was going to be like 3 months ago. So I don't know.
Okay. All right, and Pixels comes in second with $24 million, which obviously the studio and everybody involved has to consider a major disappointment, considering, first of all, how much money they spent on the movie, because there's a special effect in every other shot of this movie. And in the advertising budget, I mean, this thing was everywhere, the commercials and everything. So they've got to consider this. I mean, this is Columbia. It's Sony Columbia, right?
It's Sony, yeah, and Sony, you know, not having a good year. They already got the Aloha thing this summer. Now they're gonna have this $88 million budget. I'm guessing at least another 40 for advertising and print, probably more closer to 50. So you know, they're already trying to boast the overseas numbers, which broke records in China and stuff, but it only made like $26 million, you know. So if someone's writing some favorable stories for Sony, but I don't think it's going to pan out to be anything more or anything less than a pretty big bomb this summer.
Yeah. And I think now, what was it? Blended didn't do well. How many of his last few movies, of Sandler's last movies, would be considered disappointments?
Just almost all of them. The only ones that have boasted of profits since 2008 are the first Grown Ups movies, which is a minor success given the budget on that thing, and the animated film Hotel Transylvania.
Yeah. And that's got a sequel coming out.
Yes.
In September.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the trailer didn't make me laugh once. Well, that's interesting, man. You know, I guess people now, and I'm assuming that Sandler's already got, you know, one in the can and another one that he's making.
He's got like a 4-picture deal with Netflix. You know, we're gonna see how the Netflix experience things. You know,
that's,
I think that's exactly where he should be.
Yeah.
And I think that he's still got like a multi-picture deal still signed with Sony, I think. So we'll see how that plays out after this.
All right, we'll see what happens. Pixels, huge disappointment, $24 million. Now, what did you project it making, Eric? You had to predict more, right?
Yeah, when at the beginning of the summer, I thought this thing was going to do at least mid-40s, and the more I saw how heavily they were advertising this thing, I was thinking it was going to go over 50.
Me too.
Originally, yeah.
Me too. I thought when I saw $24 million, I was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
The tracking
this weekend suggested high 30s, and you know, and even I thought that was a little bit low. So high 30s were like the average guesstimates this weekend.
Saturday evening, not even half full at a theater. Yeah. So that should tell you. All right, Eric, Colin, hang on, guys.
Okay.
Well, we'll do the rest of the box office with Eric Childress and Colin Suter, and then we will review the new movies. We've got a lot of movies to review for you. Right here. We do it every Monday morning right here on 720 WGN. It's Nick DiGilio. More with Eric and Colin coming up. It's Nick DiGilio here, and yeah, it's the Monday morning movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me, and we check out the box office for the weekend, giving you analysis and telling you what did well and what didn't do well. Pixels, the new Adam Sandler video game, big-budget action-adventure comedy. Hugely disappointing numbers, being beaten out in Ant-Man's second week. $24.7 million for Ant-Man, which came in first place. Pixels came in second place with $24 million. And let's welcome Eric and Colin back. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
Number three, Minions with $22.1 million, right on the heels of Pixels, which has brought in a total of $261.6 million. Where's that one stand in the – how's that going to do on the despicable
– Well, it's just past the first one. It is past the gross of the first one. It's not going to hit the second one. The second one did like the 368. So this one's going to come in probably somewhere around 325, 330. Mm-hmm. But no one's going to complain about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm assuming there's probably going to be another one in the works.
Oh, yeah. You can bank on it.
Yeah. Number four, Trainwreck, $17.3 million, bringing its total up to $61.5 million. Again, doing very well. I know that's almost half of what it made last week in terms of box office.
Yeah, it's a nice hold for it.
Yeah, yeah. Despite the horrible tragedy that took place in Louisiana.
Right.
While people were watching Trainwreck, $17.3 million. Making good money. There's just no question about it. It's a solid, solid hit, and that, I think, cements the fact that Amy Schumer is going to be able to probably get a green light on a lot of her screenplays then.
I think that's the case, yeah.
Okay. I'm not happy about that. All right, number five, Southpaw with $16.5 million. How many theaters was Southpaw in?
2,500, I think.
Oh, so it's a big release.
That's a wide release, yeah.
Yeah.
Particularly for Weinstein.
Yeah.
Don't normally release their movies wide, but you know, they felt that they had something here, so.
16.5 million. How does that look, Eric?
That's very good, actually. A lot of the estimates this weekend had it around 12-13, so it's overinflated the projections again, tracking once again this weekend wrong all over the place. There's sort of an old stereotype in Hollywood, an old saying that like boxing movies don't do very well. But you know, that doesn't always seem to be the case. I mean, you think about the movies that have won Oscars, you know, over the last few years, your Million Dollar Baby, your Fighter, even something like Cinderella Man, all the Rocky movies, obviously. But you know, South Park opened very well. Now we'll see how well it holds.
There were more people in the audience when I saw Southpaw than there were for Pixels. I'm not kidding, man. All right, number six, Paper Towns, $12.5 million, based on another book by the author of Fault in Our Stars.
Yeah.
Now, I have not seen this. You know, you guys are going to review it in just a few minutes. But am I wrong in thinking that they've given away way too much in the commercials and trailers, or am I nuts?
Colin, what do you think about that?
I never saw a single trailer for this film, okay. So I have no idea. I walked into this movie as cold as you can get, so I have no idea.
Well, here's what they – let me just tell you this, Colin. Here's what they give away in the trailer. Here's what they give away in the trailer. Awkward kid, crush on girl. Mm-hmm. She seems to be, like the rebellious type. Going to teach him how to be, how to let loose.
Right.
A la, many teen movies, including a movie that the three of us really loved called The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Mm-hmm.
Falls in love with the mysterious girl, outsider. She opens up a door to his life that he'd never had before, and then she suddenly disappears.
And then leaves
clues behind.
Right.
So that they can have an adventure and find her. Now, to me, I don't need to know that she disappears. Do you know what I mean? Having watched the commercials, I'm like, okay, that's a detail that I really don't think I wanted to know.
Well, that's the first, 20 minutes of the movie.
Oh, it is?
Okay. Yeah, that's act one. Yeah, act one there. Yeah.
All that stuff, their little adventure and whatnot, that's the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then she goes missing.
All right. Well, I don't know. I didn't read any of the reviews for it. All I know is I saw the commercials, and I'm like, well, that seems to me to just be a little too much. because, to me, it's enough. Awkward kid likes cute outsider girl. That's all I need.
Yeah.
if I'm 15, I'll go see that. And if you write, and if you put the words Fault in Our Stars up on the screen, I'm there. I'm 15.
Yeah. And female.
And female, yeah. So how did 12.5 million for Paper Towns, how's that look?
Well, compared to what the tracking numbers had it this weekend, that's not very good. And I think the tracking people were really sort of banking on everyone from The Fault in Our Stars who went to see that movie show up for this one just based on the novel.
Yeah.
There was projections this weekend that had this thing close to 30 million.
Ooh.
And I thought, I'm like, that seems a little ridiculous. I think maybe this, maybe lower 20s, maybe if that holds. But like it did more than half of its business on Friday, for the entire weekend.
Oh, wow.
It did 6.3 million on Friday, and it did the rest of 6.2 on Saturday and Sunday.
Oh man.
So talk about front loaded.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And then, so I guess we'll just see this one drop off big for next week.
I think so.
Okay. Number seven, Inside Out with $7.3 million, bringing its total up to $320
million. Yay! Yay!
Number eight, Jurassic World, $6.9 million, bringing its total up to almost $624 million.
Avatar, Titanic, Jurassic World. Jurassic World 2 slated for June 22nd,
right, 2018. Right, I know. They've announced it, but I will tell you this. Yeah. I will tell you this. The negotiation with Chris Pratt's going to be a little different.
Yep.
That's going to be a little different experience.
And you know what I think they'll say? I think they'll just find someone else. If that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, people didn't go see that movie because of Chris Pratt. And I think that's also the case for Guardians, as much as I love him.
Yep.
And I love Chris Pratt. I love him. And, and you know, I think he's great. But it's so funny to see that this guy has gone from, you know, Andy Dwyer, you know, falling off, you know, chairs and stuff, to becoming like this buff, like box office, because been in two of the box office, biggest box office sensations in years.
Right place, right time.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
I know. And I hate to, like, dismiss Chris Pratt because I love him and I think he's, like, hugely – oh, and he was also in Lego Movie, for God's sake.
That's right.
Man.
That's right.
Man. All right. Number nine, Mr. Holmes. Still haven't caught up with that. I really do want to see it. $2.8 million. Have either of you guys seen it?
I did.
What'd you think, Eric?
Nah.
Yeah?
Nah. Nah.
How's McKellen?
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That always good.
Okay. All right.
You know.
$2.8 million, bringing its total up to $6.4 million. And how many theaters is it in?
Like 650.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they expanded. It was like 320 last week, and they doubled it this week. So to keep it in the top 10.
There you go. Number 10, Terminator Genesis. Spell check. $2.4 million, bringing its grand total to $85.6 million. Is it the lowest grossing Terminator movie?
Not counting the first one, yes.
Oh. Oh, well, the first one cost like $1.10, came out in 1984.
Yeah, and still made like $40 million.
Yeah. I mean, but that movie, obviously.
Right.
It was video that made that movie the cult sensation that it turned out to be.
Yeah, the sequel is definitely the lowest grossing. This is a movie that, you know, I don't think it's got many more legs on the overseas market. And if that's the case, I don't know how Paramount sticks with the plan to have two more sequels to this thing. They got them on the schedule right now, and I don't see, because this is like, I mean, it's Tomorrowland and this. The bombs of the summer.
Is Arnold scheduled to? Is he scheduled to be in the other two?
I believe so.
Oh, good Lord!
Yeah,
I think
all of them are. I think, you know, your Jai Courtney and your Emilia Clarke. I think they're all like scheduled to be in the sequels.
It was now. I still have not caught up with Terminator Genesis. Terminator Genesis came out when I was sick and you know, wasn't doing anything. But is this? I mean. So this could mark the end of the series, right? I mean, Paramount could conceivably just go, all right, that's it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of did it, you know, Sony kind of did it for the Spider-Man movies. And that last Spider-Man movie, you know, technically was a success. And they still pulled the plug.
Well, it sucked.
It was crap.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but, you know, if the movie at least makes a profit, they don't tend to just pull the plug on stuff. They pulled the plug on that. This movie's going to lose a lot of money. For Paramount. You'll be seeing that those write-off, you know, stories written in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Of what they're going to lose on this thing.
What do you think James Cameron was on when he gave the quotes?
I don't know. He was sniffing some of that blue paint from Avatar or something. I don't know.
I mean, because like when I saw the commercial and I saw it was like James Cameron who was like, hey, you're going to love this. If you're a Terminator fan, you're going to love this movie. I was like, oh, well, if it gets the stamp of approval from Cameron.
Right.
I mean, that actually meant something to me. You know what I mean? Like, because he made the first two, you know? And I'm like, okay. Well, I mean, if Cameron likes it, it's probably not, it can't be as bad as, what the hell was the other one? The Salvation?
Salvation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the third one. I'm a fan of the third one. I don't care.
We all like the third one.
What's going on with Jonathan Mostow? What the hell was the last movie that Jonathan Mostow made?
Oh.
Mostow directed Terminator 3. He also directed,
Breakdown.
For God's sake, Breakdown.
U-571.
U-571.
He did that movie Surrogates with Bruce Willis.
Oh, that's right. I like that one, too. I like all of his movies.
I think he might have done something that either went straight to video or VOD or something.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
He's in post-production on something called Hunter's Prayer.
Who's
right
in
now.
It? Who's in it?
Sam Worthington.
Oh.
Strike one. nobody else that I recognize here. So,
Man.
Is that the last thing, that's the newest thing he's done since Surrogates?
I'm sorry?
That's the newest thing he's done since Surrogates?
Sounds like it.
A TV show also. He did an episode of The Last Ship.
The Last Ship. That's the big show on TNT right now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That Idiot. I believe Idiot produced it, right, Bay?
Yeah, I think it's in his last season. I think it's like they're closing up shop on that.
Yeah. You know who's in that? I don't watch it, but I saw it on the commercials there. Is that Adam Baldwin's in it?
Yes, he is.
I haven't seen Adam Baldwin since The Chuck.
Adam Baldwin's a little nutty.
Is he?
Oh, yeah. He's like Johnny Right Wing.
Oh, no.
Oh, dude.
My bodyguard is nuts?
Johnny Right Wing. Look at his Twitter. Yeah, enjoy his Twitter account.
Oh, really?
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
It's rough, man. It's rough.
He's my bodyguard, man.
No, you don't want him to be your bodyguard.
Oh, man. Come on.
I know.
All right.
He's Animal Mother.
Come on, man. Come on. Full Metal Jacket? Come on.
Yeah.
He
I think
rules
that's where it
in
started.
That's that where it started.
I think so.
Oh, you spend 10 months hanging on the set with Matthew Modine and Stanley Kubrick, and you're going to be nuts too.
I like how you went to Modine first.
Yeah, well, Modine, you know, one of my favorite stories of and this is a topic that we can touch on sometime on the show are people who turn down roles that would have absolutely changed the trajectory of their career.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a big Full Metal Jacket. It's a huge one.
Mm.
You guys know where I'm going with this, right?
You know who
turned down Matthew Modine's role? It was written with him in mind and offered to him, and he turned it down.
I know this, but I'm forgetting.
It's Anthony Michael Hall.
Oh, I did not know that.
Anthony Michael Hall turned down that role. What the hell is... Well, that was the mid-80s.
Yeah, but he didn't really be good.
No, I know. He would have been great in it, but he was, like, all nuts at that point. He was like, yeah, I'm not going to do this, but I'll do Johnny B. Goode.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the hell? Okay, all right, so that's the box office. Number one movie is Ant-Man, and I got to say, I'm happy.
Yeah, me too.
I'm happy it was number one. Damned entertaining movie. Ant-Man, 24.7 million. Pixels, very disappointing opening, followed by Minions. Trainwreck is number four. Number five is Southpaw. Those are your top five. We'll take a quick break. It's Eric and Colin. We got some movies to review, which we do every Monday morning, so please stay tuned right here on 720 WGN. Guys, hang on.
Okay.
All right, there we go. We'll take a quick break, and I'll come back with more movie reviews. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. It's Monday morning. And that means my dad will call in at the 4:45-ish break and tell a jokey time. And I'll hang out for the first part of the Steve Cochran Show until around 6 a.m., giving us a wrap-up of what happened during the weekend. Well, it's great to be back. I want to thank everybody for the support over the time that I was off. Finished my first full week. Very happy about that. Had a little difficulty adjusting to the sleep schedule. I'll explain later, but it was a little difficult adjusting to the sleep schedule. I found myself up all night when I'm normally up, which I guess makes sense. All right, well, let's get to the movies. Eric, let's have you start.
Mm-hmm.
I Am Chris Farley, which is a documentary about Chris Farley.
Yeah, and there's going to be a special showing of it at the Music Box Theater, I think Tuesday?
This Tuesday.
This Tuesday, yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, are there going to be members of Chris Farley's family there, like his brother and stuff?
Yeah, I believe Kevin Farley is going to be there, and probably some other members of his family. But Kevin Farley, I'm pretty sure, is going to be there.
Well, Kevin Farley wrote a tremendous book about Chris Farley, about the life of Chris Farley, which is just actually a really great reading, really informative, and pretty thorough. And I don't see his name. I'm looking on the credits here, and I really don't see his name on here at all.
Yeah, I think this was more of an independent thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, and this one, I mean, this film, this documentary is essentially just kind of a great big love letter to Chris Farley, as you know, as what you know, can kind of expect it. I mean, it does, you know, cover. It doesn't break any new ground as far as you know, telling a story like this. I mean, we get, you know, his, you know, home life where the comedy began for him through, you know, his rise through Second City. There's some really wonderful moments where they almost takes a side trip into becoming a tribute to Del Close for a little while, which is kind of cool. And then, you know, take you through, you know, the movie is full of, like, really great talking heads. You know, all of his friends are in the movie. Sandler and Spade, and you got Dan Aykroyd and Mike Myers, and Bob Odenkirk tells some really great stories about him.
Yeah. Well, he and Odenkirk created Matt Foley.
Exactly. Yeah. No, they talk about that. As a film, it's, you know, it doesn't go anywhere that you don't expect it to. I mean, even when it gets to, you know, the stuff about his addiction and whatnot, you see, you know, basically it just sort of goes from happiness to long faces kind of thing. And, you know, some people talk about how they, you know, they tried to help him, but they don't really get into a whole lot of detail about that. And then he's just kind of gone and that's it. They don't really go into a lot of the dirtier details about it.
Do they have... did they get footage from Saturday Night Live? Is there?
Oh yes. Oh yeah. No, it's completely full of footage from Saturday Night Live.
Did they show any footage from the last time he came back and hosted months before his death?
Yes.
Oh man.
I think it's where Chris Rock and Tim Meadows introduce him.
Yeah.
During the thing, yeah, and he, you know, he comes back and you see him and he looks. He doesn't look good.
I vividly remember watching that episode and like I can't. Oh my God, does he look terrible? He looks like he's going to have a heart attack right now.
Yeah, no, he looked. I mean, it's like the worst he even looks in the film. You know?
Oh yeah.
For God's sake.
No. I mean, he looked. Yeah. I remember watching that episode and sitting on the couch going like, this guy's going to have to do something.
Right.
He looks like he's good. If I remember correctly, there was a sketch in that episode where they're trying to convince Lauren to have Chris Farley come back. And I want to say it's Tim Meadows sitting in the seat next to him. They're in they're in Lauren's office. And they're saying, hey, I've been keeping an eye on him all week, and he's been okay. You know, like Meadows is trying to convince Lauren to have him come back and host the show.
Yeah.
And this might have been the cold open. You know what I mean? This might have been the cold open of that episode. And and they're like, we even got him a sponsor. We have a sponsor for him. Who's been helping him out, and the door opens up, and it's Chevy.
Yeah, right.
And Chevy Chase comes in and says, hey, I've been watching him, Lauren. It's everything is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that sketch seemed to me to be very prophetic for some reason.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of Chris Farley's, obviously. It's a tragedy. I was training at Second City when he was on the main stage.
Wow.
So I ran into him a few times and I got to see him work on that stage. And he was like, he would walk out on stage. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know the kind of performer, man.
Mm-hmm.
When the person walks out on stage, you can't take your eyes. Just dominates. Whatever is happening on stage, you can't take your eye off that guy. He was that guy at Second City.
Yeah. And this sort of back and forth that you and I are having right now is exactly what the documentary is pretty much like.
Yeah.
And if the one thing that the thing really does sort of get across. Is the idea that he was kind of a grown-up man-child, in a way. You know, he had all the sort of the insecurities and stuff that you have as kids and the shyness and whatnot. They talk about how the Chris Farley show was like the sort of the closest manifestation of him, you know. But then you sort of remind yourself of just how funny he was on Saturday Night Live.
Absolutely.
I mean, the Matt Foley sketch. I mean, I obviously had not seen him do that before. So when he comes out and he does that for the first time, it's still one of the funniest things I've ever seen on Saturday Night Live.
Now, you know, really quickly, because we got a break here. And now, by the way, before we break, is this now Tuesday night they're going to screen it at the Music Box? Is this thing going to be available on, like, VOD or on demand or anything or video?
I don't know if it's going to go VOD. It is going to be opening in some theaters. I don't think it's scheduled to open in Chicago past the screening it's having this week currently.
All right.
I wouldn't be surprised if it goes on VOD. I think it might actually be premiering on Spike. television.
All right. Well, yeah, whenever it is, let's keep it updated on that, because I think a lot of people here in Chicago would be interested in seeing it.
So I imagine it'll be in an edited version, because the version that I saw is very sort of, very, very vulgar, very R-rated.
So they drop, they drop some F-bombs.
Quite a few. But that's the thing. It's just like, you're watching it, and it's just sort of a reminder. And, that's okay. And, it doesn't, reinvent the wheel as far as telling a biopic documentary is concerned.
Yeah.
But look what we lost.
Ultimately, if you're a fan of Farley, you should see this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. We got a break here. Yeah. I am Chris Farley, Tuesday night at the Music Box, and hopefully we'll get a chance to see it elsewhere. Reviews, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Monday morning movie reviews continue right here on Chicago's very own 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here, and my dad will be calling in and telling a jokey time. Eric Childress, Colin Suter are back. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hello.
Colin, tell us about Paper Towns.
All right. Well, as we said, this is the latest film adapted from a novel by John Green, and it centers on a teenage boy named Quentin, who lives in the suburbs of Orlando, and he's had a longtime crush on his neighbor named Margot, who moved across the street from him when they were 12, and they had a good, solid friendship for a while. But then, when high school started, she drifted away and lived a very carefree existence, running away a lot, following bands around. Making a name for herself as kind of a legendary, person who does that sort of thing. There's a lot of rumors spread around her at school. So one night she breaks into Quentin's house and convinces him to join her on a night of revenge against everyone who ever wronged her. She's got a big plan in mind. She's got to go to the hardware store, the grocery store, to buy all these supplies. And Quentin goes along with it somewhat reluctantly. But as the night goes along, he believes that she's interested in him again. And after they do horrible things to her exes and ex-best friends, she disappears. And nobody knows where. Her parents don't seem to care at all, because she's always running away and they're sick of it. Conveniently enough, that's what happens with that. But she leaves behind clues for Quentin, and he picks up on the clues and follows them until he feels compelled enough to go after her and bring his two buddies with him on a road trip. So this is one of those movies that kind of it takes a lot of convincing the audience that somebody would actually go through all of this for somebody else, especially somebody who doesn't really show much interest in the person. And also it's one of those movies where you kind of go, well, what are the chances of him actually finding that clue and actually pursuing it and going down this road and finding the next clue that leads to the next one? It takes a lot of suspension of disbelief in that regard. And the movie does not do a very good job of convincing, the audience that this is even possible. It doesn't help that the characters come off rather two-dimensional and that there's a lot of needless narrating, a lot of, wistful, she was, the love of my life and I'll never forget her and all that stuff. And it's all the stuff that you don't need to say, because we can pretty much see it visually without it. I guess that's one way of trying to preserve the integrity of the novel for its fan base. I don't know, but I found it very distracting and very annoying. And I just didn't buy that this guy would really, go this far for this girl who is clearly just very self-absorbed and very, just not really caring about other people or how she treats them. And I understand it's high school and your perception of people is much different than it is when you're older. And I totally get that. But the movie just didn't sell me on that kind of young love thing. And I'll tell you something about the box office performance here. My niece is 17 years old. She is a huge fan of John Green. And when I was done with the movie, I texted her and I said, what did you think of the film? Did it follow the book? Did you like it? What did you think? And she said, I hated the movie. The book is better, but the book isn't very good. And she's frankly surprised that they actually made it into a film.
Oh.
So that's a fan talking, okay? So, like, even the fans aren't really into this book by this guy who, you know, they all worship. So there's that for you. That might explain the box office appeal or lack thereof.
Okay.
So, yeah, not a good movie.
Okay. Eric.
Yeah, I'm not a fan either. I think the setup of the movie, I think, is promising in sort of a – that's sort of that old school teen fantasy way that we've, you know, we talked about earlier, you know, and, you know, sort of not that it reminded me of Perks of Being a Wallflower in a good way, but it sort of, you know, it sort of struck that vibe that I'm like, oh, I'm okay. I'm going to go along with this.
It was the first movie. It was that was the first movie I thought of when I saw the trailer for Paper Towns the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, while I was watching the setup of the movie, the one thing I thought was like, clearly this guy saw career opportunities at one point. there are some similarities, but anyway, but Colin's right. Once you sort of get to the sort of the mystery and the clues and whatnot, it's not so much that, you know, would this guy, you know, find the clues in all these locations? Would anybody find the clues in where she puts these things? There's literally like 20 minutes of this movie that's spent in like an abandoned gas station. Or I don't even know where it is, but like they're like crawling. Like it's not enough they break into this place that's been abandoned, but then they have to like find the hole in the wall and go into the other room to find the clue. And then the guy like spends the night there and like looking at the clue, trying to figure it out. I mean, it's just like Midnight Madness was more believable.
sure,
thank you very much. you know,
Eddie Deason, man, Eddie Deason,
baby. Eddie Deason, Michael Fox.
Michael J. Fox. Oh, he had no right. J for that
he
one?
He had no J in that.
Oh, okay.
It was just Michael Fox as the American Werewolf's brother. And then you get to the end of this movie, you know, and I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone. But when you get to the end of this movie, even though part of me is going, there's sort of a realistic edge to the end of this movie, the only thing I could think of was, and I actually made the video and posted it on my Facebook page. There's a moment in Eddie Murphy Raw where he talks about, you know, like a woman making a guy wait and wait and wait, and then you finally go, "I'm yours," and then his response to that's what I thought at the end of this movie. Like you go through all this stuff and you just like, and I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Even though I felt it was realistic, I still wanted to go, you know,
you know
what I'm talking about. So, no, it's not very good. And I don't know what it is about this John Green guy, but you know, even though I think his main couples are semi-interesting in a way, he writes incredibly annoying supporting characters. The best friend in Fault in Our Stars was incredibly annoying, and now he's playing the lead in this movie. And this movie has maybe the second most annoying best friend character of the year after The Gallows.
Oh.
There's this kid in this movie that I couldn't stand.
Oh, man.
So.
All right.
Not good.
Okay. All right. Eric, why don't you continue and tell us about the 657,000th movie that Woody Allen has made.
Yes.
Irrational Man.
Irrational Man. Okay. Well, this one
sounds like
sounds
like a superhero movie. It's Irrational Man.
Yeah.
Okay.
From DC.
Yeah.
This is the latest from Woody Allen. Joaquin Phoenix plays a philosophies professor, sort of a controversial philosophies professor. He drinks, he says, you know, controversial things, and he's coming into a new university where one of the students, played by Emma Stone, sort of knows everything about the guy, is kind of a, you know, fan of whatnot. I can't wait to take his class and everything. And Joaquin's character is kind of... he's very, you know, he doesn't really have a passion for life anymore. You know, he's sort of, you know, he talks about all these philosophies and these grand, you know, moral questions and whatnot, but he's not really living anything. And, you know, he'd probably, you know, feel much better putting a gun to his head than actually, you know, teaching another class. And not that this is, you know, is turning into sort of a May-December romance between the two, but the two of these two people strike up a friendship.
Wait. Is it a May-December romance in a Woody Allen movie?
Yeah, you hard to believe, right?
What?
Yeah. Well, the twist here is that actually, like, Joaquin Phoenix, like, pretty much resists the idea of it for, like, the entire movie.
Oh, wow.
But Emma Stone is just so insistent, you know, in making it happen that eventually he just gives in.
Oh.
Not that I don't want to give anything away, but that's not what the movie's about, really. Because one day at lunch, the two of them are having lunch, and they hear this woman who is in the middle of this big divorce child custody case. And they eavesdrop on her story, and they hear that the judge is being completely unfair. She's not going to get custody of her kids. And, you know, wouldn't it be, you know, a really interesting idea if this judge was just out of the picture? So Joaquin Phoenix's character starts thinking, maybe I could make this happen.
What?
Yeah. So he manages to put together this plot where he's actually going to stalk the judge, find out who this guy is, and kill him.
What?
Yes.
All right.
This is the plot of the movie, and I don't want to go any further than that.
All right.
But if this sounds, you know, if this is the 658,000th movie Woody Allen has made, you probably recognize that the sounds about like 649,000 of them.
Yeah.
So this movie, you know, Woody Allen, he's been in this stage before, but he's sort of in that Stephen King phase where it's just like, okay, I've heard you write this book like six times.
Yeah.
Already. I've seen you do this subplot 18 times already. And the idea of the plot I just described, you know, you talk about crimes and misdemeanors, you think about Match Point,
yeah.
Two much better films than this one actually is. Because this is a film that doesn't really invite the audience in to sort of wrestle with the moral quandaries that the characters are facing. It doesn't really open you up to the idea that someone's doing something wrong or right. You're all just sort of stuck in the middle of this, what just amounts to sort of plotting. And you want to talk about annoying narration that's constantly split between Phoenix and Emma Stone in the movie. Not very likable characters at all. Particularly, Emma Stone's character is particularly annoying. I think I like Joaquin Phoenix in the movie, even though I didn't really care much for the way his character is written or portrayed. This movie really sort of rubbed me the wrong way. It's one of the lesser Woody Allen efforts of late. You've seen this movie done in much better ways by Woody Allen, and this one you can skip because you've already seen it at least three times.
Yeah. I mean, and you guys know how I feel about Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you can skip in there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I realized that before you reviewed it.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. What I find really interesting is that Woody Allen, who makes the same movie over and over again, this week, one of his new movies is released here in Chicago. At the same time, an Adam Sandler movie is released, and he's made that movie 8,700 times, which is, you know, essentially about, remember when I was a kid, we went out and climbed trees.
Yeah.
And now you sit in the house and you play video games.
There's also something a little bit icky about this movie to begin with. Just the idea that, we know a little bit about Woody Allen's personal life.
Yeah.
And whatnot. And considering that he believes that in one of his hearings, he was given an unfair rap by one of the judges in the case. Wonder where this idea came from.
All righty then. All right, Eric Collin, hang on. That's Irrational Man. Eric did not like it, the latest from Woody Allen, and he's made this movie before. Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Collin and Eric join me every week. And, 312-981-7200 is the phone number and text number. You can check us out at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Like us there. We are going to talk about television shows that went out on top. Quit While You're Ahead. And we are also going to talk about television shows that really overstayed their welcome. But the reason why we're going to talk first about the television shows that went out on top is because Key and Peele have announced that this is their final season on Comedy Central. See, this makes me cry. You know, you can't announce it like 3 episodes into the new season, and those 3 episodes have been incredibly stellar. So anyway, we're going to talk about TV shows that went out on top and the TV shows that waited too long to be canceled. We welcome back Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hey, Colin.
Hello there.
All right, Colin, tell us about Pixels.
All right. Well, this is the Adam Sandler comedy, and he plays a guy who used to be the head arcade champion back in the mid-'80s, and now he sells home entertainment equipment, and his best friend is played by Kevin James, who happens to be the president of the United States. Right. Michelle Monaghan plays the love interest who Sandler meets, London Stallings, and, you know, home equipment for her, and then she works at the White House as well. And basically, the deal is aliens have misinterpreted this video feed of 80s video games and have decided to invade Earth in the form of Galaga first.
Amen.
And, Sandler is brought in as the Galaga expert, and they eventually learn that the aliens will next invade via Pac-Man and then Centipede and so on and so on. Peter Dinklage is also in it as Sandler's former video game nemesis from back in the day. And he's been in prison this whole time, and he knows a way around these games, too. So Kevin James gives him a pardon to help out.
Don't forget about Josh Gad, who plays the other idiot.
I was told to make this quick, and that seemed pretty dispensable. So,
okay.
Yeah. This is really just a great idea squandered by Sandler and his stupid writers. I will give the movie points for this because it's getting, you know, slammed left and right. I'm going to give the movie a few points. One, the casting of Dinklage. First of all, he actually has some funny lines in this movie. I will give him that. And I appreciate the fact that there, as far as I remember, not a single dwarf joke in the whole film.
Which is really, no, you're right. You're absolutely right, Colin. And that's shocking to me.
Yeah,
that there's it's an Adam Sandler movie without that.
Well, I have a feeling Dinklage has a lot to do with it because he's kind of an activist against that sort of thing.
Right.
And also, Columbus is not a mean-spirited director. He's like the nicest director ever. I don't think dwarf jokes would fly with Dinklage, but I appreciate that the movie just didn't go there, which I think is pretty cool. And there is something funny about somebody telling the president we're being invaded by Galaga. Like that's a funny little moment. Those things aside, you cannot escape. This is an Adam Sandler joint and a really just kind of stanky one at that. In spite of a good idea and in spite of a couple of good intentions, this is just a great idea in the wrong hand.
Okay. Eric.
Yeah, I mean, that pretty much sums it up right there. I echo what Colin said about Peter Dinklage. I think Dinklage is the only one that sort of – I wish the movie – he was the star of this movie because I think he does have some really funny lines in it. Let's get this out of the way. Kevin James is not funny. Let's get this out in the world. The man is not funny. The only movie I liked he was in was The Dilemma, and that was a drama.
Yeah.
Josh Gad is even worse. Josh Gad is a cancer to comedy and needs to be stopped. This is a movie that could have been.
Shouldn't he be at home counting his snowman money from that damn animated
his
movie?
Snowman and his Book of Mormon money.
Yeah. Oh, Book of Mormon, too. That's right.
Yeah. This is Trey and Matt, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I wish this movie was made in the 1980s, even with subpar special effects by Joe Dante.
Huh.
That's all. That,
well,
I'll leave it with that.
There you go. That makes sense. I hated this movie. I absolutely hated it. And I was just squirming in my seat the whole time. I got to say, as hard as Dinklage tries, to me, there was nothing fun. And I'll tell you this very quickly. I laughed once in the entire movie. One time. I chuckled. First of all, I don't know what the hell Brian Cox is doing in the movie, but he's in it. And he plays like this admiral who's sort of in charge. And at one point in the movie, the aliens have their communications between Earth and their planet have been interpreted through 80s icons. So like Reagan, they have Reagan show up and say, hey, we're going to invade your planet. And they've got Madonna showing up and all this other stuff. And at one point, a Hall and Oates show up and they say, hey, you cheated. So we're going to blow up your planet. And then when we're done blowing up your planet, we're going to sing. And then they play She's Gone. And you can see that it's footage from like mid-80s MTV where they're like on the MTV set.
Yeah.
Okay. So they play that. And then, the war room goes nuts and everybody starts to prepare for the attack and all that other stuff. And then Brian Cox, who's been very vocal about not wanting Adam Sandler and Josh Gad helping out because they're a couple of morons. Comes up and starts screaming at Sandler and Gad and says, hey, you guys cheated. See what you did. This is all your fault. The planet's going to blow up and it's all your fault. And Adam Sandler said, we didn't cheat. And then Brian Cox said, well, you heard Hall & Oates. That was the only time. That was the one single laugh that I had in the movie was Brian Cox saying, well, you heard Hall & Oates. And it was just this stupid throwaway line. It was the only time I laughed. And this is crap.
No, it's not good.
Nope.
All right. Let's see. Eric,
mm-hmm.
Why don't you sum up Southpaw for us?
Okay. This is the latest film from Antoine Fuqua. It stars Jake Gyllenhaal as a featherweight champion boxer who is very unorthodox fighter. He likes to get punched in the ring as opposed to blocking. It sort of fuels his desire to win and his anger and whatnot. And it's worked out very well for him because he's undefeated. His wife is played by Rachel McAdams, and she's sort of she sort of grounds him. They have a young daughter, and their manager is 50 Cent. Fill in your own jokes there.
Yeah.
He's being challenged by another boxer that wants to give him the title fight. And in the midst of this sort of squabble they have at a charity event, things go very badly, and Rachel McAdams' wife ends up being shot and killed. That's not a spoiler. That's also in the trailer. So it leads to sort of a path of self-destruction for Gyllenhaal's character, and he sort of goes a little crazy, little booze, little drugs, and he ends up just about losing everything in his life, all of his money, and even temporarily custody of his daughter, until he starts to train again with Forrest Whitaker's character, who was a trainer of a boxer that he beat some years ago, and they agree to form a partnership to get himself back on his feet and get back custody of his daughter and defeat the guy that was, some way responsible for the murder of his wife. This film was written by Kurt Sutter, who's responsible. He's a writer, worked on The Shield and Sons of Anarchy.
The creator of Sons of Anarchy.
Not that he should stick to television, but this is a screenplay that is very by the numbers.
Okay, Eric, hang on, we got a break, then we'll get into talking about the how we feel about the movie. Eric, hang on,
mm-hmm.
And Colin, hang on, we will come back and tell you more about what we thought of the new film Southpaw. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, 312-981-7200, facebook.com/NickDShow. Eric was just telling us about the plot for Southpaw, the new movie with Jake Gyllenhaal, new boxing film. So, Eric, you were saying right before the break that the screenplay is by the numbers.
Yeah, and I think that the film sort of bypasses some of the more interesting possible character beats and some of the more interesting thematic elements that I think it wants to go into at the expense of just sort of getting to the sort of the not necessarily feel good moments, but the sort of all the moments that you sort of expect, getting retraining himself, this is sort of the plot of half the Will Ferrell comedies, just taken a lot more seriously. And I think, this movie also, it thinks it has a lot of three-dimensional characters. I think the only one, and it ends up, being three-dimensional is the one they kill off very early, which is unfortunate. Because I think that it seemed like every time that they try to build another dimension for some of these characters, that they take a sort of a turn to sort of fit into the plotting more to what their characters do. And that includes not just Gyllenhaal, but also his daughter, as well as the rival that is challenging him. It's not a bad film. It's a very watchable film. All the actors on screen are very, very easy to watch. I think Forest Whitaker is pretty good in the film. Gyllenhaal, I think you can kind of see him acting a little bit more here, you know, a bit more mumbling, a bit more sort of, you know, downtrodden. It's not sort of the energetic, you know, where's he going with this that we saw in Nightcrawler last year. So I can't quite recommend it. It's not bad, but I got to go negative on it.
Okay. Colin.
Yeah, I'm sort of on the same boat with Eric. I think I'm a little more, slightly more, more positive on it. I think Gyllenhaal is very good in it, really. And I think the movie, the final fight scene at the end, in spite of the fact that I knew exactly what was going to happen, everything's been telegraphed, leading up to it. Still kind of got me emotionally. It still kind of won me over in that sequence. But Eric's right. This is kind of just, there's not a single surprise in the entire film. And I really just kind of found that unfortunate because, it's a good boxing underdog movie that, we tend to like those. But there wasn't anything in it that I just didn't see coming miles and miles away. So it's just, I'm kind of negative too, but at the same time, it's not bad. You could do a lot worse out there right now, but you could also kind of do a lot better.
Wow. Okay. Man, I liked it even less than you guys. I'm kind of way negative on this movie. I I've looked back at Antoine Fuqua's filmography. He's not a very good director.
No.
He's not. And I mean, I remember when I saw Training Day, I was like, oh, I really like this movie. But and then looking back, because I watch it a lot, it's not a very well-directed movie.
The writing and the acting.
But he's got, two lead performances in that movie are phenomenal. But I think he does almost everything to undermine the two strongest performances in the movie. Well, Rachel McAdams is fun to watch in this movie because it's it's a character that's so unlike anything she's ever played before.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, this connection that's supposed to be between Gyllenhaal's character and Forest Whitaker's character could be there. But I think Fuqua screws it up at every single point. I think he undermines everything that these two actors do in terms of camera placement and cutting and just the way he directs the actors. This movie is so unbelievably overwrought. There is, like, the first hour of this movie, it's like, okay, how much crap can we pile on top of this guy? You know,
yeah.
It's like, okay, I understand it. You know, part of the deal here is that he's got to dig himself out of a hole. I get it. He's got to hit rock bottom. I get it. But does the rock bottom have to be rock bottom? Do we need it piled on top? And by the way, they never once show him drinking or taking drugs. And yet in every courtroom scene, they're like, you've been drunk. And he was like, you never see it in the movie. They never show it in the movie. He crashes his car into a tree, but that could be because he's, like, you know, really depressed because of all this crap that's happening to him. So that was really unclear. And then, like, I'm not going to give anything away, but there's a moment where, like, he is now working, cleaning up the gym. He's trying to get his life back together. He's staying in this really crappy room, and Forrest Whitaker decides to, you know, let him train there, and he'll clean up the place. And at one point he comes in, and Forrest Whitaker gives him the news.
Oh, yes.
Of another character in this movie, a kid in the movie that he bonds with, that Gyllenhaal bonds with at the gym. And I'm like, really, that has to happen too? Like, that really, that has to happen? And at that point, I was like, come on, man. I mean, enough already. I just didn't care about anything that happened in this movie. I didn't think the boxing sequences were very well done. I thought the whole, like, point of view boxing, punching the camera in the face was a horrible choice. I had no emotion attached to this movie whatsoever. I think there is a glimmer of something between Gyllenhaal's character, and there are times in the movie where I think Gyllenhaal is good, and Whitaker's character that is undermined exactly and utterly by a terrible screenplay and not good directing.
Basically, it's the Monster's Ball of boxing movies.
Yeah, okay, if you want to go that way.
Sure.
All right, Colin.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a good movie. Okay. All right. Tell us about Unexpected.
All right. Well, this is, God, I saw this thing back in May at our film festival. So it's been a while.
I saw it yesterday.
Okay.
So I'm a little fresh.
All right, good. Well, this is a drama written and directed by Chris Swanberg, wife of Joe Swanberg, and it stars Kobe Smulders as a high school teacher who is suddenly pregnant while still in the throes of just being married.
She's not married yet.
Oh, she's not married yet.
No. They get married because she's pregnant.
Right. Okay.
All right.
It's been a while. but she develops a friendship with another high school student, played by Gail Bean, who is also pregnant. So the movie tells both their stories as they kind of get closer and closer to being moms and how, you know, uncertain both of their futures are at this point in time. This is from the wife of Joe Swanberg, but she has a different style from him. She actually writes scripts. I'm not saying that as a slam to Joe. I'm not slamming Joe. They're different.
Yeah.
You can tell that this is that she wrote a script and the actors are, you know, saying the lines that she wrote.
That's right.
And that's fine. And she's very good at it. I mean, this is a really good movie. This is a really well written, very insightful movie. About, you know, a character study. Kobe Smulders is terrific in it. And Gail Bean, who I don't think I've ever seen in anything before, is really good in it. Like I said, I saw this back in May. I really liked it. I wish I could give you more specifics on what I liked about it. It was during our festival, which is not the best time for me to watch a film.
Yeah.
So much going on. But yeah, this is definitely worth seeing.
Okay. Eric.
Yeah, it's a good movie. To me, one of the breakout stars of Sundance this year was Kobe Smulders, not just with this, but the Andrew Bujalski movie Results. It's one of the reasons we invited her to our film festival. We had both of those movies playing there. But you're talking about a movie that, you know, could be very by the numbers. Is a movie that sort of avoids the typical cliches about, you know, impending motherhood and the difficulties of pregnancy and whatnot, and takes a sort of a really interesting slant about the socioeconomical, you know, advantages and disadvantages to having children at different stages of your life, keeping jobs, being in school, going to college, these things. And I think it handles all of these elements very realistically, wonderfully dramatically at some points, and even sometimes very comedically. The two lead actresses are really good in this movie, Kobe Smulders and Gail Bean. This is certainly the best movie of the week. It's on VOD.
Oh, without question.
Yeah, yeah. This is the kind of movie, you know, that, you know, we love talking about, that, you know, we hope people will seek out. And you can, you know, if you can get out to the Music Box, great. If you can't, whip up the VOD and check this thing out, because it's one that you'll be very happy you did.
I really, 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 really liked this movie a lot. I loved it, actually. I thought Kobe Smulders was great. I thought Gail Bean was great. And this is the kind of relationship. This is a relationship that you don't see in movies. You know. By the way, I do want to mention that the film was shot here. And she plays a Chicago public school teacher whose school is closing down, and that's even touched on in the movie. There's a scene where they're on strike, where they're picketing.
Yeah.
So that's even in the movie. But this relationship between the character that Gail Bean plays and the character that Kobe Smulders plays I've never seen that before. Do you know what I mean? It's a relationship that I've never seen, really, and handled in a beautiful way. And one of the things I really loved is how sort of flawed Kobe Smulders character is in terms of how she handles this relationship with Gail Bean, because she's projecting on this young girl all the roadblocks that are being put in front of her. Because, you know, she's due in August, but the school is closing down. She and her husband, played by Anders Holmes, who I think is actually very good in this movie as well, decide that she's going to stay home. She doesn't want to. Deep in her heart, she doesn't want to, and she wants to get this job at the Field Museum, and she can't. Because, like, she's due in August, the job, she would have to start the job in August, and she can't have this. And there are many things that she can't have and many things that she can't do, and she projects this upon the intensity that she gives the character played by Gail Bean about how important it is to get into college and to do this and to do that. And I found that angle in the movie to be really great, and how the two actresses handle it are great. I just think this movie's terrific. There are funny moments in it, but it's mostly a pretty serious, dramatic film. I think Chris Swanberg did a great job writing it, did an even better job directing it. There's a lot of really cool shots of Chicago in it. My friend Robin Coffin, who I directed in the remount of Black and Blue, has been in a bunch of Factory shows. She plays the administrator from Illinois University who will not let the kid in.
Oh, God.
So that's the part that Robin plays in the movie. I really, really like this movie a lot, and I think it has a wonderful ending. A really beautiful ending, and just this relationship, the core relationship of this movie, this 17-year-old inner-city girl who gets pregnant by some jerk, and this, you know, woman who's got this sort of happy relationship that turns into a happy marriage, who feels like she's smothered by the fact that she's going to have this baby. You don't see that, and it's beautifully written and beautifully acted. And I just want to say that, you know, Elizabeth McGovern is in this movie. She plays Colby Smulders' mother. And I have to say that every time I see someone who's like a contemporary, like I grew up watching, like as a teenager, like in Ordinary People, and they start playing the mothers of the leads.
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Yeah. Just wait until they start playing the grandparents.
Yeah, yeah. So I really like this movie a lot. If you want to get out to the Music Box to see it, please do. It's worth it. And I watched it on video on demand, and it was definitely worth it. I really, really like this movie a lot. It's called Unexpected. So check it out. What do we got next week?
Next week we got a new Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah, baby.
And a new Vacation movie.
All right, well, one out of two ain't bad.
Right.
Isn't that, what I've read is that that's really Cruise hanging on the side of that plane.
Yeah.
What a nutcase.
Yep. Yeah.
He's insane.
Yep.
All right, and he rules. All right, you guys.
He's got special powers.
Yeah. All right, you guys, we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
All right, there you go. There's Eric, there's Colin, and they will come back next week and review the new movies, including the new Mission Impossible with nutcase Tom Cruise. All right, we got a break here.